On today's Writers Showcase podcast, author Lynn Fairchild Hawks joins us to discuss her book of short stories, The Flat and Weightless Tang-Filled Future. Welcome to the Writer's Showcase podcast. I'm Phil Nasons, and I'm the host of this weekly podcast dedicated to helping authors promote their works. Today, I'm joined by author Lynn Fairchild Hawks, who's here to tell us all about her newest release of short stories entitled The Flat and Weightless Tang-Filled Future. Lynn, welcome to the program. How are you today?
I'm great, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And it was really great getting to know you off the air a little bit. And you were brave enough to still come on the show. I love it. This is good. The other show, my daily show, that's a nutty show. You can ask your friend Bob Mustin about that.
Oh, yeah? You got to duck and cover or bring a force field? Is that?
Normally, yeah, pretty much. Can you do us a favor and tell us a little bit about yourself? I kind of just told them that you have a book.
Sure. Well, I have wanted to be a writer since I was a little girl, and I have written pretty much all my life since I was about 7 years old. I'm also a wife and a stepmom, and then a teacher too. I've taught high school and middle school for many years, and right now I design curriculum and write lessons for kids. So I've always had my foot in the classroom, besides my other foot in the literary world, I guess you could say.
That's pretty good. I usually have my foot in my mouth, or so I'm told. but I like the taste of shoe leather, so it's okay.
It works for you. All right.
Absolutely. It sure does. I always wanted to have an interview with a teacher, you know, and be in charge this time. It's a nice thing.
That's right. You could set the rules. Tell me.
How about that? Send you to your corner. Anyway, what authors were your earliest literary influences?
Oh, there's so many. I was one of those kids always in the corner with a book and trolling the library. And so I don't know if you know the Anna Green Gables series. It's a girly series that was about a little girl living in Prince Edward Island around the turn of the 20th century. But that's like, you know, an 8-book series. I gobbled that up. So L.M. Montgomery was one of my favorites. And then tons of young adult novel writers. I don't think they called it young adult in the 70s and 80s at that time. But a lot of people know Judy Blume. She was a big influence on me. And I think, you know, one other influence, and I was becoming, you know, a young adult myself at this time, but when I read To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee in high school, and I think I was 14, I was just blown away that an author could put you into such a different world. And I had just moved to the South, actually, and her book was about Alabama, and everybody knows what it's about. And it just blew me away, and I wanted to be her. So those were some of the first people that really got my attention.
All great authors, every one of them. So who influences you now?
Wow, it's so all over the map. I was trying to think about, you know, could I have my top three? I finally came up with that. But right now, there's a lot of authors that either young adult authors or I guess you call them literary authors, like the old school ones, I'd say, Doris Betts, who was a fabulous Southern writer for many years here. A lot of people know Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty. They're just the grand dames of Southern literature. And then right now, I've got a young adult author, John Green, who's become really popular. And he has a vlog called Nerd Fighters. And he sort of promotes nerds, and he's a great writer for young adults. And he's just an authentic, real voice. And in my other life, I write kind of young adult literature for adults, I guess you could say. So I admire what he does a lot. And, but on any given day, if you looked at my nightstand, you'd see nonfiction, fiction, you know, Indian authors, Southern writers, Shakespeare books. I mean, it's got a cluttered nightstand, all kinds of stuff going on. So
that makes sense. You're a writer, so you have to read. So it's important, I think. Now, what three books can't you live without? If you were like on a desert island, what three books would you want to have with you?
Let's see. Well, I would definitely need a book of Shakespeare's plays because you're never done understanding them. And plus, it would take me a ton of time to, you know, even as an English teacher, to translate certain sections. Because, you know, here's a confession to English teachers. We don't always get every line of Shakespeare, though we teach it. And so the kids probably always could pick this up, but if we skip certain passages. So that would keep me busy. And then I'd have, I definitely have the Bible with me. And because I can always be learning from that. And then I think the other one, I would, this is a hard pick, but I think Flannery O'Connor, because she was such a fascinating writer. I mean, she wrote about serial killers and she wrote about little old ladies and did it in this very classic formal Southern style. And she really blows you away with the way she gets right into the human heart and soul. And so I could just, I reread her stories all the time and I'm amazed every time I pick them up. So that would probably be, that'd be my top three.
Terrific answers. All of them are great. Now, if you were to describe your writing style, a lot of authors kind of stumble over this, which is kind of wild because you guys are supposed to be wordsmiths. But in three words, how would you describe your writing style? And I play along too after you're done. So.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, I think the first one would be modern because I like pop culture. I like current events and I like what's going on in the 2000s and late 90s and right now. So if someone picks up a story of mine, they're going to get grounded in, you know, they're going to hear Paris Hilton's name, or they might hear about, you know, a current sports team or something, because I like to stay in the moment and capture what's going on in the setting. You'll know kind of where my stories belong when you pick them up. They won't be some like random modern time. They should be kind of up to the minute. And I think the other thing about my writing is I'm pretty honest. I go into some dicey, tough subjects. You know, I deal with the racism and sexism and abuse and awkward relationships and families and stuff that sometimes makes you cringe a little bit, but hopefully is a really honest look at how we all behave. And not judging anybody, but just saying, let me just paint you a picture of people and how we do things and how we treat each other. And I guess I would just call them the last word I was thinking about is weird, because my people are weird. But what I feel is that, you know, there's that famous phrase that truth is stranger than fiction. I don't care how weird my stories get. I always hear stuff in the news that's way weirder than what I do. And so I rest assured that as strange as my stories get, there's probably something bizarre going on in the real world that I can count on.
Hey, you did a good job describing your writing. That was pretty good. Now, I would say if I had three words, I would say concise, because you had to be in this collection of short stories. You only have, what, 1,000 to 10,000 words. So you had to cram in a lot in a little bit of space, and you did a very good job with that. I would say eloquent, simply because of the way you do your dialogue. It's actually, I can feel like I'm in the area where these people are from, the dialect and everything. And that was very good. And witty. Because especially the story about the girl, I think it's the second story. I can't remember the title. I apologize, but I can't remember the title. But needless to say, the way she talked about her grandma, the racist grandma story.
Yes.
It's just witty, the way this young kid was coming across. And I really enjoyed that. So you did a good job. That's the three words I would use: concise, eloquent, and witty.
Thank you. I really appreciate that characterization. I, you know, teachers can be long-winded, and so I've always had to cut my stuff down. So I'm particularly proud of you saying concise. I feel honored because I worked hard to cut a lot of extra words out of some of these stories and not make them small novels, you know. So.
Well, it looks like you did a good job with it, because I couldn't tell that you even tried to do that, because your stories, you just did a really good job. And don't worry if you get long-winded, because I'm the editor of this show as well. So I will just cut you out.
Good.
Those okay, teachers.
I'm trying to teach a role here. This could be another calling for you, Phil.
You know, ripping on teachers, bringing them on, luring them on the trap of promoting your book so I can just rip you. All right. I got to ask, why a book on short stories? I personally like them. I don't read like the entire book of short stories at once. I kind of look at it like reading magazine articles, and I just enjoy it that way. And then I just keep revisiting. But why did you decide to write a book about on short stories? Why this?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it just sort of happened because, as one of my writing mentors, Doris Betts, who I mentioned earlier, said, a lot of times writing a short story is the, she called it the stopgap manuscript when you're writing another piece, like a novel, which is a real beast to write. I mean, a novel can take you years and years and years. And a short story might not take as long, but it's a great go-to manuscript when, for me, because I think I tend towards novels. That's my preference. But what I would do is I get an idea, you know, driving around in my car, or, you know, I'm at the DMV and I see an interesting character and I think, oh man, that'd make a great short story. And then I can do that, and it forces me, because like you said, you want to stay under 10,000 words. Ideally for me, I seem to go, my average is 5,000, 7,000 words. And when I say to myself, you got to stay within that time frame, and then what you have to do is find a really interesting moment in this person's life. Well, that's like a challenge for me, because a novel, you can do tons of scenes from a person's life, the whole life, if you wish. You can't do that in a short story, or at least most people don't try to. And so it's really, I wish I could think of a good analogy of what it's like. It's really a way to kind of show your stuff and what you're able to do in a short amount of pages. If you can have highs and lows and some suspense and tension in, you know, less than, fewer than 25 pages, you're really doing something. You're making people's blood pressure rise and you're getting people to think about life. And so that's why I love it. And this whole book kind of evolved over 10 years. One of the first story, Midriff, that's in it, I wrote that like in 2004 and, or 2003, excuse me. And so that, it's been a work in progress. And now I finally realized I have a book. This was last year. I said, I can make a book out of all these. So that's how it kind of came to be.
Well, we're happy that you did. That's for sure. Now, do you have any advice? You know, the thing is, I was going to say this. Stephen King said something about short stories. He says that if you can't write a short story and do it well, then you have no business writing a novel. Because how can you do one unless you can do the other? Or something like that, I guess. And I kind of trust what he has to say. He's been pretty successful in his career, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He's kind of one of my virtual mentors. You know, he has that book on writing, which I would recommend to anybody who wants to write. And I would back him up on that. I think if you're a writer, you should be able to play with all forms, not just novels and short stories. You should try poetry, plays, essays, all that. And what he's saying, I think, is that the outline for your short story is really a good test for writing a novel, because both of them need to have structure. They need to have good momentum and pacing. They got to have strong characters. And yeah, if you can't keep people's attention in 25 pages or fewer, then yeah, you have a problem. And it's, chances are your novel's never going to get out of the starting gate, you know, that the people just aren't going to want to stick with it. So.
Yeah. He still writes short stories. He likes to do them. That's how he got started. So I guess that's a good thing. And now you started to give some advice about his book, but do you have any other advice for young people who are writers or who will think they're writers or those who have written things that are probably don't have a clue on how to get it published? Do you have any advice for them?
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's so much, but I'll do the simplest. If you're a startup writer, you're just getting out of the gate and you have a lot of ideas, I would definitely read as much. And I know that sounds like boring teacherly advice, but you should read something new every day or stick with something like a novel or a short story and read and reread and study it, because you got to learn how the people you admire the most are doing their craft. And one of the things I've been doing, I have a blog, and I would sort of take myself to school because I have a full-time job and I can't go get a master's in fine arts, you know, in creative writing right now. I may do that someday, but I said, I'm going to do a personal MFA. I'm going to take a section of a story and I'm going to blog about it. And what is this writer doing that's so good? And that forced me to kind of go to school, and I saw my short stories over the last 10 years get better and better. And the messages I would get from magazines I was submitting to is, wow, that's really good, but not quite there, to finally, oh my gosh, we want a copy of this, or we don't have room for this one, but can you send us something else for our next issue? And I saw how that close reading started to really make a difference. And that's what you're supposed to do when you go to school, is read hard and as much as you can. And then, of course, you know, write every day. That's another basic piece of advice. But it's funny, you run into a lot of people who say, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And we writers can talk about writing without actually doing it. And so the important thing is to do it every day. I mean, it's like exercise, and you have a writing muscle. And if you don't keep it in shape, your writing is going to fall apart. And then finally, the other thing that saved me is writers groups. I have two, and I've also got a lot of virtual writing partners like Bob Mustin and Dave Fraunfelder, who've been on this show, and they keep me honest, and they also give me deadlines. So thankfully, when I have somebody to communicate with, I'm not just by myself hiding in my little office here. I'm accountable to somebody, and then I say, okay, you know, what do you think of this? And then I get really motivated. So I'd say find writers groups, find people that can back you up and help you keep going. So read, write, connect. I think that would be my little piece of advice for people getting started.
That's a great advice. You know, this blogging thing, I'm a big proponent of that. The three most successful authors that I've had on the Phil Nason Show, two of them have actually been on this one too, including a New York Times bestseller, all began by blogging, and that's where people found them, and that's how they built a community, and more importantly, they put it out there and were critiqued by people who they didn't know and whatever, and they learned a lot from it. More importantly, they built that audience, and when the publisher found them, they already had 20,000-30,000 books. That's how quick it came. You know, that's my friend Ira Wagler sold 40,000 ebooks in 1 month.
Oh, that's fantastic. And that, like you said, they've built a community and a presence online where people, it sounds like they were getting people to not only get to know their writing, but give them feedback on it, which that is really the way to go for a lot of people now. There's you probably heard of Wattpad, where you know, the award-winning Margaret Atwood, famous novelist and short story writer, she's on there along with all these apprentice newbie writers, and they're all sharing their work and getting feedback. And I think that's a brilliant strategy to get your stuff out there and find people who can already start following you before you even get published.
You know, what we're going to do is we're going to leave a link to that site in the show notes. You'll have to send it to me because I'd never heard of it, but it's okay. That's great. You know, Lynn, we're off to a flying start, and I'm really happy to have you here. When we return, Lynn is going to read from her collection of short stories, not all of them, but whatever she wants, called The Flat and Weightless Tang-Filled Future. And you're listening to the Writers Showcase podcast exclusively on Max Sports Channels.
So I'm going to read from two of my short stories in The Flat and Weightless Tang-Filled Future. And the first one is from a story called By the Water. And in it, we've got a poor dad. He's having a rough day at the beach with his sons. He's divorced, and he's got three boys, and he's by himself. And the morning at the beach didn't go too well because he felt uncomfortable supervising all three boys in the water. And so he's now taking them to the pool because he feels that's safer. And he's sitting there watching the boys in the pool, and there's an elderly lady sunning herself and reading nearby. So just a quick intro here. Martin is the father. And then we've got three boys, Jeremiah, who's the oldest, Stephen, Alex, and Bobby, and then the elderly lady. So I'm going to just jump right into the pool scene here. "This is boring," Jeremiah yelled. "Let's go." Martin looked at the woman, who winked at him. "Your attitude is boring," Martin said. Jeremiah's face turned red under the woman's gaze. She chuckled. "How old is he? 15? "No, 13. "Tall for his age?" Martin nodded. "The oldest and youngest are in the 99th percentile." Unfortunately, Stephen Alex was looking to be a runt. In that way, and in that way only, he took after Marjorie. So what am I supposed to do? Jeremiah screamed. It was so loud, everyone twitched. Do, snapped Martin. Swim, you idiot. You sure aren't impressing me or the lady here. He had twice used this line with some success in restaurants, now that Jeremiah was showing occasional interest in girls. Jeremiah yelled, Lady, where? Martin looked at the woman. Her smile grew tight as if someone had shellacked her face. It had to be big, his action. He yelled, Get out of the pool, now! He strode over to where Jeremiah clung to the side of the deep end, grabbed his arm, and yanked him up. The boy scraped his arm along the concrete and fell on his stomach. Martin bellowed, Now get up! Tears clung to Jeremiah's lashes, but he refused to cry. He stumbled to his feet. Behind them, Martin heard Bobby's whimpers and Stephen Allen speaking quietly to him. Martin threw a towel at Jeremiah and said to the other two, Get out. Then to Jeremiah, Apologize to that lady, now. Jeremiah rubbed the towel across his bird chest, his face red and puckered. The scrape on his arm bloomed pink and speckled with blood. Head down, he walked toward the woman, stopped several feet from her, and muttered, Sorry. He turned and came back. Oh no, Martin said, Do it again. Look her in the eye. The boy could have his same torture. The grandparents Jeremiah never had to deal with used to do worse whenever Martin struggled to make eye contact. Look them in the eye. It was a command with such darkness at its edges, it felt like cussing when Martin said it. Jeremiah stood still a few seconds, making Martin wonder if he would have to shove him back to the woman. She looked like someone had struck her across the face. She said quietly, Once is enough. Do it, Martin snapped at Jeremiah. Then he said to her, He needs to learn. Jeremiah trudged up to her, kept the same distance, and raised his head like a mechanical doll. I'm sorry, he said. Martin guessed Jeremiah was staring somewhere around the vicinity of her neck. It would have to do. Martin turned to the other two and said, Your brother acted like an idiot, and therefore he gets treated like an idiot. Bobby, don't you ever let me catch you acting like this. Bobby burst into high-pitched, desperate wails. Martin led one, snot-faced and screaming, and the other two, trailing towels, away from the pool. He left without saying goodbye, because something choked his throat so hard he could barely breathe. So that's an excerpt from By the Water, the first story of my collection. And then the second story, I'm just going to read you a very brief part. It's a completely different voice. It's a 10-year-old girl named Wendy, who I also have a novel about coming out soon. This story is called My Grandma is a Racist, and you're going to hear Wendy's voice from the get-go. So I'll just read you a little bit of that. They're fighting again, Grandma and Sonny. Cindy and I are secretly taping them from behind the couch. Grandma's visiting from North Carolina, and when she comes over, she brings her bottle of wine. She's mad because Sonny hasn't made dinner yet. Grandma says, and I quote, not even any gluten-free crap in this food-free zone, unquote. I whisper to Cindy, Grandma gets mad when she can't get her wine by 5. She lets me sip it sometimes, but it's nasty. Cindy whispers back, My mom would lay down and die and then come back from the dead to wring my neck if I ever drank. Sonny yells, What do you know, Mother? Your diet's full of trans fats. You'll pickle your liver with high fructose corn syrup. I'm 64 and healthy as a horse, Grandma says. Why change now? Cindy whispers, So is your mom going to cook? She likes to wait and see if Grandma will take us out. Why doesn't she cook? She says women have to make choices, and domesticity is not hers. Cindy shrugs. I don't think she knows what domesticity is. Dictionary.com never explains anything good, so I had to guess it means something about making dinner. I can spell it perfectly now. Now they're fighting about politics. Their voices are louder than the bald guy who screams at the bow tie guy on TV. Sonny yells, George Bush and Fox News have brainwashed you to fear Muslims. Grandma snorts, and we hear the wine bottle go pop. Then when Grandma drinks, the fighting slows down. I whisper to Cindy, Since George Bush started running against the John Kerry guy, the fighting's got worse. They fight on the phone, and whenever she comes to visit, Sunny's not a huge fan of John Kerry, but she says anyone's better than George Bush because he lied to start the war. Don't say that to my dad, Cindy says. I've got cousins in Iraq. But it's the truth. I wouldn't say it if you want any more dinner at our house. Cindy's mom makes really good tacos and spaghetti and chicken. I eat there as much as I can. And that's an excerpt from My Grandma is a Racist, set in 2004. You might have already picked up on that. So those are my two excerpts from The Flat and Weightless Tang-Filled Future.
Welcome back to the Writer's Showcase podcast. We're here with writer Lynn Fairchild Hawks talking about her book, or collection, I should say, of short stories called The Flat and Weightless Tang-Filled Future. Now, Lynn, you write literary fiction, and for the average reader, it might sound like highbrow, elite, $100 a bottle stories rather than a satisfying draft beer stories. Why would people who don't typically read literary short stories want to read your work?
Well, that's a great question, because I think, like you're saying, you know, literary fiction has kind of a bad rap that it's only for certain types or people with certain education. And I believe, and you mentioned Stephen King earlier, I think short stories are for everybody. And my stories, I use a lot of dialogue, and my people are very real from all walks of life. And not to say that, you know, stories that are written by people in MFA programs or who, you know, who've only been writing for a couple of years, that their writing doesn't matter. I think it's just, it's important, if you want to get read today, you got to write about what you know first. And secondly, you need to write about people that you know are real to you and that you feel can express something that's important to you. And I think I do that pretty well. I have teachers and grandmas and dads who are having trouble raising their kids and just everyday people. And I think that would appeal to a lot of readers who aren't sure that they would normally pick up a collection of short stories.
I think so too. That's why you're on the show.
Thanks.
Otherwise you wouldn't have made the cut. But anyway, this is a collection of literary short fiction. Typically, writers of short stories submit to literary magazines, like Stephen King does. Why did you choose the self-publishing path instead?
Well, this was a decision that I didn't make lightly, and it really came about last year after about 10 years of submitting to lots of magazines, getting published in two different places and getting a lot of awards and also nice rejection notes. I got, for the first story in the collection, both the New Yorker and the Missouri Review wrote me and said, we love this story. We don't have room for it. And they gave me very specific feedback on what they loved about the dad and the sons. Send us something else. And I felt like that was my cue to say, you know what? There's not enough room in the pipeline. And that's what's so exciting about being an author today. People are realizing that if you do the hard work, you get the editors, you slave over your stories for years, you get it copy edited, you get a good cover, that you can be your own publisher if you're willing to do all that. And so that's why I was saying at the beginning, it was not a decision I made lightly. I had to sit and think, am I willing to do all this stuff? Because, you know, the literary magazine, the nice thing about it is, okay, they'll publish you. But here's the deal. They only come out 4 to 6 times a year. There's probably only 30 to 40 magazines that I really want to get published in that will pay you and recognize you and help your career. But that pipeline is incredibly narrow when you think of the thousands and thousands of people that are submitting to each of these. And self-publishing allows you to go find your readership. And it's out there. I'm already finding it's out there. People are writing me saying, wow, I've enjoyed every single one of your stories, and that has been so gratifying. And I had to wait. Do I want to wait another 5 years to see some of these stories that are really ready to go get out there, or are they ready to go now? And I said, okay, now. So that's how, that's a long-winded answer to your question, but that's kind of how it all came about.
No, it's fine. In fact, you never know too, by self-publishing, a big publisher could pick it up and republish it.
True.
That's what I would shoot for. I wrote a tennis book with a DVD, a teaching book, and the publisher went bankrupt. And people were trying to encourage me to write it just self-published. I said, you can't, because it's got a DVD. I need a promotional tool, and it's tough. But you give great advice there. Now, what does the title, The Flat and Weightless Tang-Filled Future, actually mean, Lynn?
Well, that name, or that, well, actually the title came to me from a line from my final short story, which is called by the same name. There's a character in it, and the story is set in Charlotte, North Carolina, 1976. And this is from a woman that's in her head. She thinks that this is how the future looks. It looks flat, it looks weightless, and it looks full of an artificial drink like Tang. She's really freaked out by the future. And that line came to me, like she's seeing her future laid out ahead of her. And, you know, every time she picks up the news, there's an oil crisis, or there's women burning bras in the streets, and you know, she just doesn't get what's happening in modern life. And she's old school. She's from the country. She's moved to now what she considers the big city, and her life just feels overwhelming. And the reason I picked it for the collection is there's a number of characters in my book who feel this way about the future. They feel overwhelmed or blown away by the way their life is ending up, and they feel kind of out of control. And I think, I hope that feeling kind of relate, we can all relate to that sometimes. It's like, you know, the news or whatever's going on, we say, what is happening? But I also hope that even though that may sound like a bit of a negative characterization of life, that people find in these stories that there are positive things to look at. There is redemption and hope in some ways. And so that's what I hope the stories throw out there to people. But, you know, that in the meantime, what makes for the tension is that future is not looking so bright that I have to wear shades kind of thing. It's actually looking kind of bad. So that's the tension in the stories.
That's a great answer. Now, you taught high school and middle school for many years, and I work with the same type of kids. How have they influenced your writing?
Well, you know, if you work in a service sector, like, you know, anything, whether coaches, teachers, you encounter all kinds of people with great stories. And I was talking earlier about the famous, you know, truth is stranger than fiction line. And you just run into so many stories at the post office, the DMV, inside a school. And I learned so much from being a teacher about people. And I still do in my role as educator. And so I've seen all kinds of funny, strange things happen, and it's inspired my imagination to make up funny, strange things. Because in some ways you borrow from real life as a writer, but in other ways you just go down all kinds of rabbit holes creating crazy stuff, and it's so much fun. It's like being a kid. So I guess I'm perpetually a kid, from even though I was supposed to be a role model and a teacher, because in those places you learn about people and it sparks your imagination. And I think also when you write a story, you're kind of learning, teaching yourself stuff. That's sort of, I think, how it connects to education. You have like discoveries about human nature and life as you write. So some people even call it therapy, I think, to write. So anyway, it's education itself. I think that's how it connects to my career.
Excellent answer. Yeah, I know all about working with kids, and I've worked with them from all over the world. So it's really interesting. Now, in the last several years, the conventional wisdom has been, don't expect to get a collection of short stories published, because traditional publishers really don't want them. That's what people say anyway. But the landscape's changing now. Why do you have hope for the short story form? And you must have hope because you published a book of them.
Yeah, I'm always optimistic. And I find that, like I was saying earlier about the narrow pipeline in publishing for short stories in literary magazines, you're well aware that that's happened for novels and short story collections, and people are starting to say, hey, is that really true? Is it just because there's only these big publishers who are willing to publish X, Y, and Z that I can't put my, whether it's a fantasy novel, short story collection, romance novel, can I not put mine out there? And people are saying, yes, I can. And there are readers out there. So I think that's the first big myth that's being busted, is that the readers aren't out there. I think publishers have said, we only have so many dollars to throw behind certain books, and they've made some budget and marketing decisions that work for them as a company. but it may not be really what the readers want. And now we've got crowdsourcing on the internet. People are basically able to communicate across, you know, thousands and millions of miles and tell each other what they want. And so authors can really connect. And the other thing, I mean, as you're well aware too, I think attention spans have narrowed, and the short story is a perfect answer to that, because we've got so much to do. We're expected to move as fast as machines nowadays. So maybe I only have time when I'm sitting at the doctor's office waiting for my child to come out of the room, or I only have time, you know, before I walk to the dentist, I've got time to read a short story. And, or at night before I'm exhausted and fall asleep, I've got time to read 5 pages, not 50. So I think our leisure time is, we were also competing with so much media and interesting stuff on TV and films. So a short story is a great literary answer to that. I don't know if it's a modern problem or just the state of things today. So I think we have room for those out there.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, with the Kindle out there, you can put that in your back pocket. You can take it anywhere. You don't even have it, and it's thin. You know what I mean? It's not like you can bring your entire library with you. Because I live in a resort, and I don't have room for books. But they're all in my PC for Kindle. And I like it that way. Absolutely. It's perfect. Now, you call your short stories Southern. And I know two of the folks you're hooked up with over there in your writers group. And I would say Bob Mustin is Southern.
Yes.
But here's the thing. You were born in California, and I've been dying to ask you, how can a transplant like yourself, a Californian no less, call herself a Southern writer? I've been dying to ask you this question.
Well, I think two things. I've got some Southern cred because I married a boy from Mayberry, Mount Airy, North Carolina, Greg Hawks. He's a bluegrass country musician, so there's that. We got a clawhammer banjo in the next room. So that's the first thing. And our cat is named after a bluegrass musician. So there's that. And I've lived here a lot. My high school years were here. And then I moved back here after college in California, working there back in 95, been here ever since. So I'm not a full native, but a transplant who's basically put down some roots. And the other thing about me, I wasn't a military brat. I was a corporate brat. My dad's company moved us around a ton, and I learned to be a bit of a chameleon in whatever culture I landed in. And I think, you know, in California, it's such a melting pot of different cultures. And my ancestral roots are from Colorado, but I have a lot of immigration in our family from Russia and Italy and Scotland. And so we're true Americans in the sense of, like, in some ways you leave this culture behind and then you kind of adapt to the culture that you're in and you change. And I find that, you know, we lived in Belgium as a kid, California, North Carolina. My parents moved to Singapore. I constantly have been moving and shaking a lot. And so now I'm in the South for quite a while, and I've started to feel Southern. I don't know if that's legit, and true Southerners would say, bless her heart, forget her. You know, but I like to think that I've adapted here and put down some roots. So, but Bob's the real deal. And fortunately, he's embraced me and Dave as fellow honorary Southerners. So,
and me too. You know, I've lived here in Greece for 11 years, and I never adapted their culture. I don't feel even the slightest bit apart. I'm just here for tennis, really. Even though things have changed in my life because of being here, I honestly just never did. I guess it's because I'm just too stuck in my ways and I was too old when I came here. But anyhow, you've written for the education market, 3 books, I believe. And at one point you had your own literary agent, and now you're a self-published author. And how did you get here? How did you go from that to here?
Well, you know, it's sort of the same journey as I was talking about with the publishers. I had to come to the conclusion after a year with a literary agent. And by the way, she wasn't interested in my short stories. There's not a market for that. She was interested in my novel because it had potential for the young adult market. And I understand her reasoning. She wanted me to really pitch it and write it for 16-year-old girls. And I felt that my novel was really for adults. It's a young adult novel for adults because it's about a girl obsessed with Michael Jackson who wants to go back to the 1980s. And a lot of people who are baby boomers and Gen X and Gen Y can relate to that. So my writing kind of pitches to an adult audience. And where she and I had to part ways is we had different visions of who the book was for. And she had a certain audience that she thought it would sell to. And I felt that it was more of a hybrid book and it could sell to other audiences. And so, you know, we parted very amicably. It was a pleasant parting, no problems, but it was a difference in seeing the market. And I do trust agents and publishers. They know the market far better than an individual author like myself. So I'm not saying that I have a better sense of the market. I just had to follow my heart. That's really what it came down to, is that in my gut, you know, and heart, I just said, I can do this. It's going to be really tough. But if I'm willing to put the sweat in and the time, I can find my readership. And it's really interesting how things are just starting to happen and falling into place. And, you know, you keep your day job. You don't just abandon everything and say, oh, wow, I'm self-published, I'll be a millionaire. I mean, you've cited a couple people who've had tremendous success. And that's going to happen for certain people. I don't expect to be like a shot out of the gate, especially with short stories. You know, that's not like a mystery or a thriller or historical fiction or romance. Those tend to do really, really well in selling, you know, the thousands of ebooks a month. And so I've got realistic expectations, and I learned a lot working with an agent. And she helped me hone my writing and taught me lots of things. So that was a great experience. I wouldn't ever regret that. But now I'm really ready to be my own CEO of this Lynn Fairchild Hawks business, and learning a lot as I do it. You know, you have to be an artist, but you got to be a business person too.
You're singing my story, because I'm independent too, and it's a good thing. I don't think it's going to last much longer, but we'll see. Anyhow, how do you really feel though about traditional publishing and literary agents? Because I think this is kind of like a separate question, right?
Right. I think they have a great place as a pipeline that vets for good work, though we do know that bad stuff is published all the time, even by traditional publishers. But most of the time, you've got editors who know their stuff, and they should be, you know, it's like agents in the sports world, you know, who has the most talent. That's, you need to have a group of people who are experts. And I think that's what publishers serve, agents as well. And they also are advocates for you. They can be that person there to help you with the contracts and the foreign rights and translation and all that. So, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I'm not saying I'll never go there. If I have an opportunity, I will seriously consider it. And I think, you know, because there's a lot of great advocacy and support and editorial help you can get. What they can't really provide today is the marketing help. That it used to be the case that you could guarantee that you'd get maybe a publicist and book signings and things. Now it's really falling more into the lap of the authors to do all that marketing and promotion. Get your own website, get your publicist, do all this stuff. We can't guarantee you, but a very small advance, good luck. I think that's sort of the relationship now between publishers and authors, and that's okay. I mean, it's just a market change, and so people have to, if I were with somebody, I'd still have to do a lot of the stuff that I'm doing now. And I think that's just, so that's, I think, what made my decision easier to walk away from the traditional world and ride this revolution that so many authors are doing now with self-publishing.
Yeah, I think you're right in a way, because I would see that traditional publishing, like the people I cited, I had two authors that were with Tyndale, and one of them just was on Paul Azan's show. And I can honestly tell you that they marketed her. They couldn't believe that I had her on this show, and they marketed the show. And that's actually what's kept the show alive, because I was going to cancel it because it was going nowhere. And it was unfair to the writers. But you're right. I think that doing it on your own is good. And my hope for you is that a big-time publisher picks up this collection and republishes it so you can actually just quit your day job and write, because you do a fantastic job, young lady. I appreciated having you on the program.
Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate that vote of confidence. I'm gonna carry that around with me like a mantra. Phil said.
Now you know why I'm such a great coach, right?
That's right.
Anyway, I have one more question for you. You have a free, I hate to say this word free, because we're trying to promote your books so you actually make money, but maybe this will do it too. You have a free download day coming up on March the 22nd. Giving away copies of something you worked so hard at, why did you do that? What made you decide to do that?
Yeah, it's a good question because I do struggle with it sometimes. But I think my short stories will hopefully people who are maybe not short story readers, don't know my name, they take a chance with me, easy enough because it's free. And then they realize, oh, there's a story in there that's about this girl, Wendy. And, oh, she now has a novel out about this girl, Wendy. I kind of like that story. I'm hoping this is going to be the strategy that a lot of other self-publishing authors use is going to help me get my name out there. It's one of those marketing tips that for some people it works really well. And I will say, for you know, piece of advice about writing that I've read recently, a lot of self-published authors are saying that are really successful. They're saying that if you have several books, this works well. Now, I only have two, the second one coming out soon, but there's a tie-in, and that's the other piece. If your books tie in and they have the same character shows up, it's a good strategy because people, if they like your character the first time, they may come back for more. So I'm hoping on that, that people will like Wendy and want to hear more about her in the next book. And I have a lot of other books in me, in progress, sitting on the shelf. So it's just a matter of getting those out there. And I might build a readership with people who take a risk on the free download. So I hope people check it out.
And Wendy would be the young lady that you read the story from in the second segment, correct?
That's right.
See, I figured it out already, didn't I?
Made that connection. Thank you.
My pleasure. And you know something, when you do publish, you make sure you let us know. We'll have you back on so you can talk about it.
Oh, I'd love to. And this has been really fun, Phil. Thank you.
I try to make it as fun as I can. People told me I was too serious the first few shows and I had to stop that and be crazy, Phil. So I did. And it's turned out much better. Anyway, thank you so much for being on the show with me today.
Thank you, Phil.
All right. And that's going to wrap it up for today's Writer Showcase Podcast. Until next time, this is Phil Nasons. Enjoy the reading.